You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is My Other Family. Lauren Davis and Ricky Garcia met when they were teenagers, about to launch into the world, working together at a preschool in Issaquah. Lauren was drawn to this young man.
And I had a huge crush on him, and everybody knew it.
Soon after that, she invited me to go hiking with her.
While Ricky really liked Lauren, he did not have romantic feelings for her because he's gay.
At the time, I wasn't out to anyone. And I invited my nephew and my niece to come along on our hike together and totally ruined her plans.
I was the first person he came out to. And at that point, I had already known for some time.
I do remember that I could not say the word gay. I remember Lauren actually called me that night, and she actually like forced me to say it. She forced me to tell her that I was actually gay, because I had such an issue with it. But yeah, that's how it happened.
And then Ricky and I became very close friends. I spent a ton of time with his family. He has a ton of nieces and nephews who were much younger at the time, and got to go to all their birthday parties, spend holidays with the family. We took trips together. We went down to California. We took his little nephew. We went all over the place in the summer together.
She constantly jokes about how like she adopted herself into my family. My family loves her, and so do I. I mean, Lauren was always just very caring, very giving, very genuine. Yeah, she's family. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
When I graduated college, I had studied abroad in Ghana, and I was hell-bent on moving there after college, and I did. I got a Fulbright scholarship and studied there, and Ricky continued his studies back home, and he was the first in his family to go to a four-year school, and of course we kept in touch, but because I was in Ghana, I wasn't necessarily aware of the depth of what was happening.
It was one of those things where I knew I was feeling depressed. I was feeling really anxious. Most of the time, I wanted to escape all of that. And I just started to self-medicate and take whatever it took for me to escape reality. But I just became uber dependent on, in particular, alcohol. And then I slowly started to dabble in other things, such as like heroin. I mean, I was doing marijuana. I was popping a lot of pills. I went from it being manageable to just being completely uncontrollable. She came back, and I remember she was sitting in the room with me.
I remember he was wearing a Mexico jersey. His family had just come back from visiting Mexico, and he just broke down crying in my arms.
And I was drinking straight vodka from a water bottle. She had no idea.
The first time I ever had to call an ambulance for him was one morning when he urinated in the bed overnight and was just sort of convulsing and was salivating at his mouth and uncontrollably and crying uncontrollably, and I completely inconsolable, but I didn't know he was drunk. I mean, as silly and as strange as that sounds, at that point, this is just a few days into this two-year journey, I didn't know he was drunk. I thought he was just having some emotional breakdown. He'd been, because he was hiding the alcohol, and his body movements were so off, and I called 911, and they asked me what was wrong, and I said, I don't know what's wrong, but I've never seen anybody in this condition before. They took him to the ambulance, said they were taking him to Harborview, and then we found out that his blood alcohol was over 400. And I was just, I mean, I had no idea. And that was really the beginning, and I learned a lot very quickly after that.
And that was the first time that I was admitted into a psych unit at Harborview. That was my first rodeo at Harborview.
That first hospitalization was terrifying. I remember the first time he was admitted there was at night, and was hugging him to leave and he wouldn't let me go. And he said, you know, are you coming back in the morning? And I said, of course. And I was there 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. every single day. And I just would sit with him on the floor of his room and he would shake. And somebody, I have no recollection if this person was a nurse or a medical assistant, but this person said to me, you know, Lauren, you really should just let Enrique be, because sometimes you just need to let them go crazy so we can see how sick they are. And I was haunted by that comment because I felt like he was slipping through my grasp, and I knew so little about what was wrong with him or how to help. And what she said was terrifying to me. And I didn't take her advice. I sat beside him through that whole hospitalization, and he eventually stabilized and got into outpatient. And then again, I went back to Ghana and he relapsed. And this sort of pattern went on for the next 2 years of hospitalizations and brief stability and sobriety and relapse, and on and on and on.
I felt ashamed of everything that I was doing. I felt ashamed of the way that I was feeling. I felt ashamed of who I had become at that point, right? Most of my family didn't want to deal with me. I no longer could hang out with my nephews, which I loved, right? I could no longer take them to the park or to the movies by myself like I used to.
His parents would have brought down the moon for their child. But his parents, in so many ways, were unable to help. Parents couldn't speak English or read or write in terms of the medical charts and understanding. His dad, unfortunately, was battling cancer at the time, and his dad passed away during really the height of Ricky's illness. And so his mom was full-time caregiving for the dad. And so he kind of bounced around from different siblings' houses, but everyone sort of had their limit of ability to deal with that in their own home. And I was the constant. I had no limit for that. August 2012, I was sitting in 5 West A, Harborview's psychiatric unit. It was Ricky's fourth stay there. And it was his discharge planning meeting, and this relatively young psychiatrist is looking at Ricky and he says to him, "You're 25 years old and you're dying of your addiction. If we were in another state and I could commit you involuntarily to addiction treatment, I would. But my hands are tied under Washington state law." And my heart just shattered on the linoleum floor of that hospital room. He told me my loved one had the wrong disease. If he had a mental disorder, he could be saved. But because he had a different brain disease of addiction, he was going to be discharged to die. And that was a wholly unacceptable answer, not just for my Ricky, but for anybody's loved one, for anybody's child, for anybody's sibling, for, you know, each of those people is somebody's everything. At the time, the only option that families and loved ones had in the state was to try to have a loved one involuntarily committed via the mental health system.
I remember Lauren would constantly tell me, like, when we're at the ER, to just tell them you're suicidal, so they won't let you go. Even though those times I wasn't really suicidal. I mean, I just had to say that so I could get some sort of help, like an inpatient bed at the psych unit, so I could at least be safe for 7 to 14 days.
When he would end up in the psychiatric hospital, he would detox, and then he would have some clarity. He would start to feel like a person again, and his family and I would surround him with love, and he would start to have some hope again. And eventually, after one of those incidents, he chose to go to addiction treatment voluntarily.
And I refused to die, and I refused to let this addiction take over completely. This is it. And that was August 27, 2012. The biggest challenge was, of course, learning to live with all these emotions that you never really had to deal with. I had to learn how to reconnect with my family. I had to learn how to, you know, tell the truth, right? Because I was just so very used to lying all the time to get what I wanted. I remember telling Lauren one day that I wanted to do something that was meaningful, that was uber impactful, that I wanted to be a part of something that was gonna change and help others, and help their journey and ease their path to recovery. And what better place to make change than Olympia, right?
After Ricky entered long-term recovery, I started schooling myself on the behavioral health system. I had to learn both the mental health and addiction treatment systems simultaneously, and eventually I was able to specifically identify what was the problem in state statute that didn't allow an adult or child to be involuntarily committed for addiction. And once I had that identified, I went to work and I started talking to lawmakers, and that was, but now we're in the summer of 2014, and that was really the birthplace of what became Ricky's Law.
I think this law is going to be a piece of legislation that's going to be that thing that's going to almost say no for you when you can't say no for yourself, right? Like in my case, Lauren was my hope. She was my armor bearer. She was my person who led me through, one that never gave up on me, even though a lot of the times I wanted to.
Ricky's Law went into effect this past April. It allows for the involuntary commitment of a loved one who's suffering from addiction. The hope is for people to get sober enough to make a decision about entering a treatment program. Enrique Garcia has been sober for 6 years, and Lauren Davis will be spending a lot more time in Olympia. This past November, Lauren was elected to represent Washington's 32nd Legislative District in the State House.